Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Tommy from Design for Living in Neptune, New Jersey.
How you doing, everybody? My name is Tommy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Tommy.
And thank you for inviting me out here tonight. Are we on Zoom? I was going to say thank you to Lauren, who I didn't get a chance to meet, but only back and forth through texts. I am really grateful to be here tonight. My home group is called Design for Living. It's a big book study meeting that meets Sunday night at 7 o'clock in Neptune, New Jersey. We're about 3 miles from the Jersey Shore. So if you're ever down the Jersey Shore and you don't want to fight Sunday traffic coming home right before you get on the parkway or head towards 195 coming out this way, we're situated right there. I am eternally, eternally grateful for that home group. That is where I heard the solution that finally saved my life. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by people just like you that took a treatment commitment into the facility I was in way up in North Jersey in, that was 1992, my first time around. And the cool part was with you, when you guys brought that meeting into the facility I was at, you guys were just kind of telling your stories and asking, you know, hey, can you relate to this or anything? It wasn't a membership drive. You weren't trying to sign up a whole bunch of, you know, prospects or new members. You weren't trying to convince me that I was an alcoholic. But all the counselors and all the staff there, day in and day out, were trying to convince me that I was an alcoholic. And you guys just said, hey, we're going to tell our stories. If some reason it seems to help us. If it works, if it helps you, great. If not, it still helps us. So that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous in a treatment facility. I don't want to go into a whole long, gory details of how I ended up in that treatment facility, but I think what's important is, like, we need to have that level of identification that I earned this right to be up here, to have a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember my first drink. I probably don't remember really my first drink. I remember my first really, really, really knocked down, fall out, but I don't remember my first drunk. I'm the youngest of three boys. I had two older brothers. I wanted to emulate them in every single way. You know, growing up in the 70s, my brothers were doing, you know, drinking and doing other stuff. And I thought that was cool. Right? That was like a cool lifestyle. So little by little, I got involved, started drinking, and I'll stick to singleness of purpose, but there was other things involved. Basketball is a big part of my story. Obviously, by my height, I wasn't fit to be a jockey. But it was a really big part. It was a big, big part of my life. From the time I was 7 years old, I loved to play hoops. I was fortunate enough that as a freshman in the high school that I went to, I was able to start 4 years of varsity. And I had a plan that if I played my cards right, kind of thought or had the idea or, you know, enough knowledge, right, that I wasn't going to be NBA material, but I had an opportunity if I did everything I was supposed to do to play professional hoops overseas and make a pretty decent living doing it, which I thought was great because, you know, I'm not making NBA money, but I'm getting paid to play a game that I love to play. How awesome, like, right, that they say, like, if you love what you do for work, you never work a day in your life. And that was really my goal from the time I got into high school, was to hone my skills enough, get into a good college, get my education, progress through the ranks, you know, of the basketball fraternity, and eventually get on a plane and fly somewhere overseas and play professionally, and then get paid for it. And I did everything I could to work towards that goal. And my drinking career, playing hoops was the one thing that kept me from crossing that, we talk about that imaginary line, right? It was the one thing that kept me from crossing that line, from going just a little bit too far. I always had that idea, I got practice tomorrow, big game coming, whatever it was. It kind of kept me in check. But we all know about the progressiveness of this disease. It doesn't care about my dreams. It doesn't care what I'm looking for. It just keeps chugging along and chugging along. I got hoops, I got my disease, and little by little, alcoholism started to overtake it. There's a line in the doctor's opinion, I think it's the doctor's opinion, you know, sometimes it causes, I'm paraphrasing here, right? Sometimes it causes us to make the ultimate sacrifice or the supreme sacrifice. And as we're sitting down reading that with a sponsor, we're always pointed out that that means, you know, we're taking our own lives because we can't live like that anymore. Well, for me, that became a concept farther down the road. But at that time, the supreme sacrifice for me was my dreams. It took my dreams right from me. I gave it up willingly and didn't even know what was happening. So 4 years of playing varsity, I get a nice scholarship to a small little school up in New England, in Connecticut, right about a mile from the Long Island Sound. They had just come off their first ever NCAA appearance. So now I'm the blue chip freshman. We don't have a football team, so the basketball team is treated like royalty. On the campus, all around town, pizzerias, bars, you name it, we were treated like royalty. There's that line in Bill's story where he talks about he finally arrived. My freshman year, when I got onto that campus, that was my, oh my God, I have arrived moment, right? I didn't have mom and dad around. I could drink exactly how I wanted to drink and not have to worry about anything. All I had to do was make sure that later on in the afternoon, my butt was in that gym for practice or in the weight room or on the track or whatever we were having to do, preseason drills, captain's practice. I could drink without a care in the world. And I'm like, oh my God, I've arrived. Right? Plus I was treated like royalty. Right? That was my aha, I've arrived moment. My freshman, you know, March Madness, brackets and all that stuff. We make the NCAA tour. We win our conference. We make the NCAA tournament. We got blown out in the first round by the eventual national champion. But I go back. Now I'm into my junior year. I'm going to school there year round. I'm taking summer classes there. I'm drinking on a beach by myself every night. I make a little cooler, sea breezes or bay breezes or something like that. And I go sit up in the abandoned, in the lifeguard chair on the Long Island Sound, and I'm looking out at the lights, and that was kind of, it was hot. There was no air conditioning in the dorms where I was, just fans. That's kind of, I drank myself to sleep just about every night in the summer that I was up there. My junior year starts, it's back to school. I'm living on campus year round. Everyone starts coming back. I got a townhouse on campus. Everyone starts coming back for the junior year. I'm captain of one of the captains of the team. My favorite Grateful Dead cover band is playing in somebody's basement, the Cosmic Embryo, right? Cool name. And, you know, I'm down there, kegs flowing, beers flowing. Somebody says, hey, let's step outside, a little this, a little that. I say, cool, practice, NCAA, it's going to be a couple weeks, maybe a month away until it really gets official because it's September. And technically, you can't start until sometime in October officially with the NCAA. So whatever I'm doing, by the time that comes around, those tests come around, I'm going to be good. I'm sweating, I'm running, I'm lifting, I'm playing, and there's going to be nothing left in my system. I'm good to go. Well, sure enough, a month later, the NCAA comes around with their little cups, and it's, you know, time for me to give my donation. And about 2 weeks after that, I get a letter from the Dean of Student Services that I need to report to the Dean of Student Services. I had no idea what it was for. There was, I don't know what it was called, but there was like some meningitis or whatever was going around college campuses and people needed to be vaccinated. And I'm like, God, that's probably what this is for. I show up to the Dean of Student Services and they told me what happened. They told me that my PA came back, I was positive, blah, 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 all this. And I'm in shock. I'm a junior, I'm the co-captain of the team. The NCAA is going to suspend me for 30 days. My parents don't know. My classmates, my teammates don't know what's going on. My coach has no idea. This was on a Friday afternoon. And they said, listen, we're going to make this official. We're going to sit down with you and the coaching staff, and we're going to talk to them on Monday and let them know that, you know, you test positive, you're going to be suspended for 30 days. So now I got the weekend to let this marinate. Right? How am I going to deal with that? Like, you talk about shame and guilt and the biggest thing of all, fear. What is everybody going to think? Right? I'm not that evolved that I don't care what people think. I always care what people think about me. What's everybody going to say? I'm going to be suspended for 30 days. We were on like local TV, local radio. Like, how, this is like, my life's coming to an end. I don't know how to process this at 20 years old. I don't know how I'm going to move forward beyond this point. So I go to practice. I know it's coming Monday. I go to practice Saturday. Ball's getting, I'm hitting in the head with passes. I'm dribbling off my foot. I'm getting yelled at by the coach. Practice is over. I take a shower. I get dressed. I walk up into his office and I says, "Coach, I'm not into this anymore. I was never in the service." But I said, you know, this is like being in the military. I played hoops because it was fun. This isn't fun anymore. This is more like all lies. This is more like a job. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And this guy that assistant coaches, you know, met my parents when I was in high school. And, they, you know, they put a lot of effort into getting me to go to their school. And I just walked away from it like it was absolutely nothing. I was good liar, right? Talked to mom and dad. I thought, it's not fun anymore. I always played because it was fun. And now it's not, I don't want to do this anymore. This is like a job. We support you 100%. You don't want to do it anymore. We got your back. All lies. But that's how I'm good at that, right? I'm good at gaining those allies like that. On Monday, because I had already told the coach on Saturday, the dean of student services, and due to confidentiality, you know, laws, actually it's laws, they could have gotten a lot of trouble, they weren't allowed to say anything. So when I told them, like, "Hey, I'm not on the team anymore," they weren't allowed to tell the coach what exactly happened. So I got away with it without anybody finding out my little secret that I came up hot and I would have been suspended for 30 days. So now nobody has to know about that. In the beginning of the year, every year, if you're on an athletic scholarship, you sign your letter of intent every year. So earlier in September, I had signed my letter. So my tuition, my townhouse, my books, my food, everything was paid for. I never went to class again. I never went to class. It was like a floating party. There was bars up by the beach. I never went to class again. So when May rolled around, my blood alcohol level was higher than my grade point average. Right? And I was not, like, matriculate. I was not allowed to, like, move up into my senior year. I failed out of school is what happened. I never went to class again. There goes my dream, right? I'm not playing hoops. I'm not going overseas. What am I going to do? Like, fear, man. I just got, like, total enveloped, like, paralyzing fear. Oh, my God. What am I going to do with my life? The best thing and the only thing I knew as a remedy was, let me crawl into a bottle and I'll figure it out later. And that's what I did. All those feelings, all that shame, all that guilt, I just drowned those feelings with booze. Like I said, singleness of purpose. There was a lot of other things involved. And shortly thereafter, that's how I wound up into that rehab up in North Jersey in 1992. I spent 28 days there. I got out. I spent Christmas and New Year's there. I got out January 4th. And I celebrated the holidays with my family that I had missed on that January 4th, that evening. My girlfriend at the time, still from school up in Connecticut, lived out on Long Island. I grew up in Elizabeth. I drove her back to Long Island. I came back over to Goffles Bridge. I stopped in a little bodega, and I brought a 12-pack. And I was supposed to go to a meeting that night, and I was two beers into it before I realized, oh my God, I'm 24 hours out of rehab. And I'm two beers into this before I even realized that I was like supposed to be starting down this road of recovery, right? I had 28 days sober in rehab, the longest I've ever had since I was a really, really small kid. And now I'm drinking two beers and they talk about, like, Bill pounding on the table or the bar, like, "I can't believe I did this again." I basically did the same thing in my car. I can't believe this. I just got out of rehab and I'm two beers into it before I even realized it. Back then, this was like way pre-cell phones, but beepers were really prevalent. And when you got a beeper number embedded in your brain, you kind of don't forget it for a while. So I made that beeper call and one thing led to another. And now I'm off to the races all over again. 24 hours from being out of rehab. I told my parents after I dropped her off, I was going to like drive back home. I'm going to go to a meeting. I know the guys go out to the diner and stuff after. Now it's like 7, 8 o'clock. Okay, I'm at the meeting, but I'm not at the meeting. I'm at the spot. 9, 10, 11 o'clock comes. All right, I can tell them, well, after the meeting, I'm at the diner hanging out with you guys, you know, talking this whole recovery game thing. And by 11 o'clock, I pass that point of no return. I can't go back home. Right? Plus, my jaw is going from side to side. I mean, I was dead giveaway if I walked in the door. What am I going to do? So I stay where I was till the next morning. Waited till mom and dad left the house to go to work. Probably terrified because they don't know where I am. They're calling her in Long Island. What time did he leave? Oh my God. You know, thank God for, you know, parent support group and our Al-Anon family groups that really, you know, my parents eventually wound up getting like a black belt in Al-Anon. But it was, I didn't know what to do. I waited till they left for work and went home and robbed the house. And I went on a 2-week tear. After that 2-week tear, I did what any respecting alcoholic would do when everything hits the fan, is I called mom crying. And I said, Mom, I got no place to go to, you know, can you guys help me again? And they said, we can't help you the way you are. We'll let you come home and use the phone. You can call the facility back that you were at, and that's it. We're going to let you in the house just for a couple minutes, use the telephone call, but, you know, not after what you did in the past and after what you did last week. We're not comfortable. They already changed the locks on the door, so I had to knock. They had to let me in. They let me use the phone. I called Sunrise House back. I said, told them what was going on. I put my dad on the line. And he drove me right to General Hospital in Elizabeth and left me there overnight until they sent the van down to pick me up. That van came down, picked me up. I go back to the same rehab that I had just gotten out of 2 weeks ago. The people that were just getting there when I was getting ready to leave are now still there. You talk about like walking back into a place with your tail between your legs. They're still there and I'm coming back in. And when the day I left, they had this little, custom of giving out marbles. People would give you different color marbles for what group you're in, and it went back to like somebody's mother had been there, and they were so happy that she got sober and she found recovery that she got her marbles back. So they had a custom of giving out marbles, right? Those same people that were giving me those marbles and saying, oh, you're going to be great, you're going to stay sober, I had to go back and tell those people exactly what happened, right, and get honest all over again. They suggested after about 2 weeks that it's probably not a good idea after I lasted 24 hours to go back to Elizabeth. So they suggested a halfway house for me that was on the bay, in Raritan Bay, down in Keyport, New Jersey. It was all guys at the time. It was about 15 guys. I walked into that rehab or halfway house totally busted, man, totally deflated. And I went through it was a 90-day program. I was getting ready to start living on my own. I think they call it phase 3, where you still come back for aftercare, but like I'm on my own. I'm paying my own rent in my own house with a couple other guys that I've been in treatment with. You're going to meetings on your own. You're doing your own thing, but you still have that like that support group back at the halfway house. Well, it was a little bit of time between that and when my lease was going to be ready, and I was playing on a sober softball team. Somewhere close to home, and then I went off on another tear over the course of that weekend. That was May of 1993. I came back, I got honest, I told people what happened, and that was my sober date for 10 years, May of 1993, May 15th of 1993. There's a saying that we hear all the time, nothing changes, nothing changes. Not part of my story. My story is, if nothing changes, your sober date is going to change. And that is exactly what happened to me. For 10 years, I came to this fellowship. For 10 years, I went to meetings. For 10 years, I hung out with you guys in the diner after the meeting was over. For 10 years, I cleaned out ashtrays. I folded chairs. For 10 years, I got an A+ in fellowship. I probably had a B+ in service, and I had an F in recovery. The meetings that I was going to, and I went to meetings just about every day, the meetings I was going to, nobody was telling me how to get better. I was going to topic meetings where you put the topic in the hat, pull it out. I was going to speaker meetings where for 20 minutes the speaker would tell me how much he drank and what happened to him when he drank. And then I found that, hey, my life's great. Thanks for letting me share. And I'm going, how do I stop drinking? How do I get this off? You know what? It, like, how do I get this off of me? How do I get it? That feeling of I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. That feeling of I got that hole that no matter what I try and do, nothing's going to fill that in. I did that for 10 years. When I went to meetings, I felt good. When I was hanging out with you guys at the diner, I felt great. You dropped me off. Then I started to, oh man, now I got to get through the day and count the minutes almost till I was getting back to a meeting, you know, later that next night. It was an absolutely miserable way to live, right? They say we're restless, irritable, and discontent when we're not drinking, right? I wasn't drinking. And that's exactly, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I was still a liar. I was still a cheat. I was still a thief. I'm the guy, I'll steal your wallet. I'll help you look for it. It was like a miserable, miserable existence. A lot of the stuff, right, the consequences that got me into AA weren't part of my life anymore, right? You know, once we put it down, little by little, some things get better. But if we put it down, if I put it down and I don't do anything about me, I get worse. And that's what happened. I started getting worse and worse and worse. So by the time I got 9 years sober, I'm contemplating how am I going to kill myself because my life sucks right now. How do I get out of this? It's going to be pills, it's going to be bullet, so just do, you know, hot shot, whatever. I got to get out because this AA thing's not working for me. How do I get out of this lifestyle? I made the craziest decision I ever made, 100% sober. I picked up that first drink. I was too much of a chicken to kill myself. I said that AA is not for me, it's not working. I still feel miserable, so why don't I just go back to drinking? I never went back to anything else, right? Singleness of purpose. I didn't go back to any other stuff. I stuck to the booze when I went back out. I went out for 8 more years and caused more damage, more destruction, right? Our book talks about where that tornado tearing through people's lives, right? And that's what I just, more damage, destruction, heartache, guilt, shame, fear, right? All those labels, I was consumed with it. At the end, or while it was happening, nobody really knew what was going on. I was living by myself in an apartment down in Neptune with my dog and my cat, right? I was in a relationship with a woman who was divorced with a couple kids, so we didn't live together, and I hid it from everybody, all right? I went from being the kind of drinker, right, that you invited to your parties, right? We're going water skiing, we're going fishing, we're going to be out in the boat, we're going camping. It was like, I was the party guy, right? I was a popular guy. People invited me out to do things. By the time I went back out and those years progressed, I became a lonely, solitary, isolated drinker in my apartment with my dog and my cat because I couldn't let anybody know. As far as my family knew, I was still in recovery. As far as the woman knew, I was the guy, I was in recovery. I wasn't really going to meetings, but they kind of knew that, like, hey man, after all the stuff he's been through, he can't be drinking again. So by the time everything caught up to me, it took 8 years for everybody to find out what was finally going on. And I minimized it. I said, you know, nobody knew that it had been going on for 8 years. I told it, you know, we're great at minimizing. It's only been happening for a couple months. I didn't want anybody to think like this has been my lifestyle for the last 8 years. So it's only been a couple months. I don't remember exactly when, but I dabbled here and there. And I knew enough from the stuff I remembered from rehab. I knew enough from the stuff I heard you guys share at meetings that, yeah, I kind of picked up right where I left off, and the progressiveness of this disease kind of just caught up with me. I thought I could handle like one or two, but don't worry. Don't worry. Everything's going to be cool. I'm going back to AA. And the only reason that I said that to her, and my mom was still alive at the time, and the rest of my family, is just to get everybody off my back. Because deep in my heart of hearts, I really believe AA don't work for me. I did it for 10 years. It don't work for me. It might work for you guys. But after 10 years of going, in the beginning, it was every day, you know, and then second or third, by my second, third, fourth, fifth, it was, you know, three, four, five times a week. It was going to conventions and service committees and all kinds of stuff. It don't work. But it was like the key word. Everybody in my family and her, they heard, oh, he's going back to AA. He's going to be okay. They'll take care of him over there just like the last time. Maybe he knows what he has to do. He'll really like bolster his program up this time and everybody will live happily ever after. I was living with two guys at the time. I had gotten kicked out where I was. I moved in with two friends of mine that were divorced and they were sharing a big, big house in Shark River Hills, which is like a mile from the beach. And the only reason I started going back to meetings was one, I had to get out of the house, right? Because everybody knew what happened. So now I have to be out of the house. I got an hour to kill. I might as well go to an AA meeting. And the other part was this gives me 1 hour to figure out how I'm going to put my life back together. It gives me an hour to figure out what lie I told to her, what lie I told to him. And God forbid everybody was like sitting together at the same place. My head would have exploded. So would theirs if they actually heard the truth. But it gave me an hour to figure out how to fix my life. Right? And it got pointed out to me later on down the road in recovery this time around that I was doing one of the craziest things we try to do is we try and fix the problem with the same thinking, right? The same alcoholic mind that created the problem. I'm going to fix my problems with the same crazy ideas, same crazy mind that started the problems to begin with. So I had a friend of mine, because I hadn't been to a meeting in 8 years. I called him up and I said, hey, Charlie, you know what's going on. Carol Ann's already talked to you. She knows you're an AA. Obviously, you know what's going on with me. She told everybody what's going on. I don't even know where the meetings are anymore. Can you take me to a meeting? And I was hoping he was going to be like my little spy, right? He was going to say, oh, yeah, he's going to tell her. I picked him up. I took him to a meeting. Oh, you'd be really proud of him. He got honest. He got so honest, he was crying at the meeting. So I'm at my first meeting back now for 8 years. It's an open discussion meeting on a Friday night at the Lighthouse right on the beach down in Seagirt, New Jersey. And I made sure I raised my hand right away as soon as they were like, okay, the meeting's open. Hand goes right up. And I start talking about how I had 10 years and how I relapsed and I can't believe I'm back. And some of that was true. But the other part was an act because I wanted Charlie to be able to report back. Oh, he got honest. You know, I wanted him to let everybody know that I was doing what I told everybody I was going to do. After that meeting, this dude comes up to me. And it turns out that I knew his sponsor who had died with like 48 years. Way back when I came around the first time, this dude used to come to the recovery house I was in and pick me up and take me to meetings and take me to diner after and drive me back home and let me bitch about my roommates and everything that was going on. And this guy was like a solid, solid AA old timer. He was one of those guys, said like the most spiritual thing you could ever hear, right? When I came out of the recovery house, he would roll the window down and say, get in the car, right? The most spiritual thing that anybody can say to him. And I did. And I became his, back then, I think they called them pigeons back then, right? So I get in the car and he showed me all around the meetings and all that stuff. Well, anyway, this guy that I met, this guy, Tom, was his sponsor. And I found out that Tom had since passed away. He got real sick of cancer and he had passed away. This guy said, hey, listen, there's somebody in AA was an artist. They came up with this pen and ink drawing for his mask card. There's this meeting on Sunday night that I think you're really, really going to benefit from. Why don't you meet me there? So I said, all right. I got told everybody I was going back to meetings anyway, so let me just show up there. So I wound up going to two meetings on Saturday. Sunday came. I said, I told Sean I was going to meet him there. I got to go to a meeting anyway. I figure out my lies, figure out my deceptions and my schemes. Let me just show up there. Plus, I can get a real cool memento of my old friend Tom. I go to this meeting. First time I ever walk in there, Design for Living, Sunday night, 7 o'clock. I show up at 6:58, no big book. I slink down against the wall. There's 300 people every Sunday night for a big book study meeting. I slink against the wall. I find a place to sit down. Meeting starts. No big book. This guy's sitting next to me, has the book open. They're doing the fifth step. The fifth step? I was never going to do a fifth step. He pushed his book over so I could follow along with what the speaker was talking about. There was a woman speaking that night on the fifth step. She had gone through the whole process, had this incredible spiritual experience with her sponsor. She was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was telling her experience, strength, and hope. She'd read a little bit from the big book, right out of How It Works. She'd interject her own experience, and I'm like, oh my God, you people actually do this? Because for 10 years, there they are, I didn't do any of that stuff. Right? If I went to a 12 and 12 meeting, and I went to a lot of those back, they called those step meetings back where I was going to meetings, they called a 12 and 12 a step meeting. If you read a paragraph, no matter what you read, you were allowed to share on it. So I'd be reading something from the ninth step about making amends, and I would give you my opinion or my hypothesis on what I thought this process of making amends was about. I had no experience. I never did a step in my life. I told you I had zero recovery back then. So now I'm at this meeting not paying attention, thinking that, okay, I got to fix my life. And God somehow hit me with this like 2x4, start paying attention to what this woman is sharing. And all of a sudden now I'm looking around this room of 300 people on a Sunday night to make sure nobody's looking at me. Because I realized I had a tear running down the side of my cheek from what she was sharing. And I looked around and I wiped the tear away, and now I'm not thinking about my little plans and my schemes anymore. I am focused on every word that this woman is sharing. And my sponsor says this all the time, when heart speaks, heart listens. And she was talking from her heart. And we were talking about fishing earlier. She hooked me. She hooked me. She hooked my heart. And I was keyed in on every word she said, and I was blown away. I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, and I never heard the solution presented like that before. So much so that when we closed the meeting, I made a beeline, thanked her for sharing, and the chairperson of the meeting, and I just spilled it. I've been in Alcoholics for 10 years before. I never heard anything like this. I want it. I have never heard anything like this. And he says, oh, you know, I said, yeah, I got like four. This is my fourth meeting in 3 days. I think I got 5 or 6 days. I went in. I never heard anything like this before. Hold on a second. I want you to meet somebody. He goes and he grabs this dude. Guess who he grabbed? 300 people in the room. The guy that I sat next to that pushed his book over to me so I could follow along with what the woman was reading when she was reading out of the fifth step. First coincidence. You got to be kidding me, right? What are the odds? 300 people, the dude I sat next to. He says, hey, this is my friend Chris. Chris, this is Tommy. Tommy, Chris. I want you guys to get to know each other. I just want to let you know, Chris is ready to start sponsoring guys. This guy's totally on. He had this really cool experience. He went through all 12 steps. He's gone through the work. He's telling me I was his sponsor. I took him through. He's ready to start sponsoring people. You'd be perfect for him. Me and Chris start talking. They're cleaning up the meeting. It's getting ready to close. We make a plan to meet the next day down at the Red Bank Marina, have a cup of coffee, just to chat, right? Before we get involved with anything, we're just going to talk, feel it out, see what it's all about, right? I find out before I walk out the door, I ask, oh, by the way. So I was, we're walking back out to our cars. How long have you been around? He says, 10 months. I said, oh my God. I don't know if that look was on my face or not, but it was definitely up here, right? So when I walked into that basement, we meet in a school cafeteria in the church, in the school basement, my ego was totally, totally deflated. I was busted, man, like busted. I had nowhere to go. I'm figuring out my lies. What am I going to do? My ego is totally, totally deflated. This dude tells me he's got 10 months. My ego all of a sudden just inflated to this big. And in my head, I'm thinking, are you freaking kidding me? I had 10 years at one point. What's this dude with 10 months going to tell me? Right? So then my next question, he looks kind of young. He said, how old are you? Turns out at the time, I was 42. He was 32. He was 10 years younger than me. Oh my God. You got 10 months sober. You're 10 years younger than me. And I'm going to take direction from you? You're going to be my spot? Are you freaking kidding me? Like I said, didn't say that, but it might have been on my face. But anyway, the ego already, right? Inflates to this big. So I kept my promise. I met him at the marina at like 6 o'clock on Monday. We got coffee. We started talking. One thing led to another. He told a little bit of his story. I told him a little bit about my story. The coincidences, the way God showed up to show the similarities in the way we drank and what we did and just circumstances of our lives. And most importantly, how we felt about some of the things that we did. I told him flat out, I said, dude, I came down here tonight. I was going to give you the honor and privilege of being part of my phone network. But in my head, I was thinking, there is no way that you are going to be my sponsor. Not with 10 months and 10 years my junior. I'm thinking, I need that old crotchety AA guy with the half a cigar that's going to say, shut up and sit down, kid. Take the cotton out of your ears and ram it down your throat. You don't know what you're talking about. God had another plan. This dude had an incredible experience going through all 12 steps with a sponsor. And he was ready to pass that on. And I just happened to be the person that got put in his path. And when I talk about fire, man, this dude was on fire for AA. I made a commitment that night to meet him. It was Monday. He said, you know, he gave me directions to his house. Him and his wife had just had their first child. They were, she would take him upstairs at 8 o'clock, and we sat at his dining room table. I showed up with a big book, with a notebook, with a pen and a highlighter, exactly like he suggested. We sat down at that table every Thursday night, and I had the coolest experience of my life, man. The coolest experience that eluded me and evaded me for years and years and years. When it said ask, we asked. When it said write, we wrote. Actually, when we said ask, we prayed. I met him every Thursday. We started going through that book. You know, he did the typical thing we do in AA. Oh, the blank page in the beginning of the book. This is what you know about alcoholism, blah, blah. Right, he hit me with all that stuff. One of the things he asked me to do, which I had never heard before, he said, I want you to, between Monday and Thursday when we met, he said, I want you to go home and read the first 164 pages. Just see if you're probably not going to understand it, but just see if anything interests you. You know, if you even want to do this, because there's some radical stuff that goes on in here. I mean, if you're interested, you know, we'll talk more on Thursday, but just, I don't want to waste your time. You don't want to waste my time, but just see if you're interested and go say, hey, listen, while you're at it, circle the word must every time you see it. Now, I guess he learned that in like sponsorship school or something, because I had never heard that before. So I figured, I can read, you know. So I read it, took a pencil, started circling the word must every now and then. Maybe I missed a couple. So like Wednesday, before I met him on Thursday, I said, let me read it again. So I read the first 164 pages again. Totally mind, made no sense, didn't know what you guys were talking about. But I kind of had an idea, and I said, you know, this, I'll give it a shot. What the hell, man? If it worked for this guy, maybe it'll work for me. So I show up at his house Thursday, I open my book, and I tell him, hey, Chris, and I did everything you asked me to do. I read it. I actually read it twice. I said, I circled the word must. I said, you know what? I didn't tally them up, though. I got them all circled. You want me to just go, like, add them up real fast? He goes, I don't care how many. I just want to see if you're willing to do it. I still use that today with my guys, so... We sat down, and I had this incredible experience. It took me, I don't know, I was about 7-8 months by the time I got to my ninth step. Started knocking on doors, started making appointments, calling family members, telling people, oh, look, I'm back in AA, I got this thing we do, it's called the ninth step, you know, I got to get over victory over drinking, I got to do this stuff. Are you willing to meet with me? Everybody, ex-girlfriends. I had to talk to my current girlfriend and see if she was cool with that. They had to talk to their husbands, because they're since married, to say if they were cool with that, and everybody was cool. So I made a point. I'm driving out to Long Island. I'm driving South Jersey. I'm all over the place making amends. And I have this incredible, incredible experience. One of the really important things that Chris said to me right when we first met is, you know, he gave me the typical, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism? I'm like bobblehead, you know, my head shake. I had no idea what any lengths even was. And then he said, hey, listen, when we go through this process, you're going to have this really cool experience. And I need you to promise me that you're not just here to take, take, take. That once you have this experience, and he was hell bent that I was going to have it. I was a little iffy still at the time. if you, when you have this really cool experience, that you're going to take other men through this same process. And, you know, quote bobblehead again. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. It's not going to happen, but on the off chance that it does, I'll be happy to pass it on. I had no idea what I was in for. One of the things he, after that, he said to me, he goes, listen, my job as your sponsor is just your guide. I am not here to give you my experience. I'll share my experience with you, but my role is for you to have your own experience. And not so much with the work or the book, but to have an experience with the God of your understanding. And I said, okay, that sounds cool. Yeah. And still, this ain't going to work for me. It might work for you guys, but it ain't work for me. I'm still just along for the ride right now. But for some reason, I believe that he believed that stuff. And we hear that all the time when people talking about sex. That, you know, just believe that I believe. I started to, like, he was all in on this. And I'm like, hey, man, good for him. And maybe something, even if it just makes my life a little bit better, maybe something will trickle down. Maybe I'll glean some little bit of information that'll help me out along the way. And what happened is after meeting with him week after week after week, I started having my own experience. I got introduced to the God of my understanding. I went to a Catholic grammar school, an all-boys Catholic prep school, and I went to a Jesuit university. I had no idea who God was. I really believed that if there was a God and I did the kind of things that I did to his kids, that when the end of my life came, I was going to be in a place that was really hot for a really long time. And he really probably didn't want a whole hell of a lot to do with somebody like me. That was the concept of God that I had. Really, there's probably something out there, but he don't really want anything to do with me. And in the course of that, going through that work, I started to understand and come up with this concept that my God's about love. My God's about mercy and forgiveness and understanding and compassion. All the good stuff, right? Not judgment, you know, not fire and brimstone, but a God that was actually on my side. You know, Bill talks about a personal relationship with the Creator. And I started to develop that after all these years of this, you know, religious upbringing, so to speak. I started having this own concept of a God of my understanding. And what happened, and it wasn't just Chris, but it was so many of you guys in the meetings that I started going to, because now we hear like the term new pair of glasses. I'm not only have a new pair of glasses, I got a new set of ears. I'm starting to hear this program presented in a whole different way, right? I used to hear all the time, oh, if you're willing to make the effort, if you want what we have to offer, and are you willing to make the effort to get it, you're ready to take certain steps. What effort? And I didn't really know what you guys had to offer because all I heard was a lot of junk a lots. I didn't hear any solution. But now I'm starting to hear solution. And I'm starting to hear relationships getting better and jobs and relationships with a higher power and dependence on that higher power. And oh my God, I want you guys. We got a friend, Ralph, out in L.A. who talks about a spiritual experience. You can't describe a spiritual experience. You can't put a definition on what a spiritual experience is. It's different for each one of us. He says it's kind of like describing how an orange tastes. How do you describe how an orange tastes, right? You can't, but you can make that orange sound so good and juicy and succulent and citrusy the way it tastes that you're going to want to go out and get your own orange. And that's what you guys started doing to me about a spiritual experience. You started making it sound so good and so juicy that I wanted to go out and have my own spiritual experience. And I got that opportunity by going through those 12 steps with a sponsor, right? That same guy, Ralph, says all the time, the 12 steps are not the prize. They're not the treasure, right? The 12 steps are the map to how I get to the treasure, right? X marks the spot. So I follow the map. I follow the guidelines. You know, my sponsor to this now is very big on that word in the preface to the, in the big book, if we follow these directions precisely. I don't get to deviate and pick and choose. I follow directions precisely, and guess what? I get to have that spiritual experience. It's kind of like in our big book, it talks about when Roland Hazard's meeting Carl Jung. He's trying to, like, says it, like, over the course of eons and centuries, over the course of history, every once in a while, every here and there, somebody, boom, they just get struck sober. But they have no idea how it happened. If you talk to the guy back in olden days, you know, how did that happen? The guy has no idea. He just got struck sober. And it's happened. It's been proven that along the, throughout history that every once in a while, somebody just, boom, gets struck sober. What AA, and what Bill and Bob found a way to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is capture lightning in a bottle. They found a way through those 12 steps to duplicate a spiritual experience over and over and over and over again. And what I become is just a link in the chain. And I keep that promise that I made to Chris, my first sponsor, 11 years ago. I celebrated 11 years last month, August 9th, 2011.
Amazing.
I get this opportunity now to follow up on that promise and take other guys to do the same work and tell them, this is not about me giving you my experience, but this is about you having your own experience by going through this process. And what happens is that lightning in a bottle, we be, boom, the next link in the chain, the next link in the chain. And what happened for me was I thought I, you know, when I had my first sponsee, and I started sitting across the table from him in my kitchen and sharing my experience, strength, and hope with him. That's when things really took off, right? I thought I had a nice little foundation going. But when you start to see the light come on in somebody else's eyes who's hopeless, who's filled with doom and gloom, right, who doesn't think there's a way out, and you take them through the process, and that little flicker, right, and the whole, all of us in AA and the fellowship, we start fanning that little fire until, and then that guy becomes on fire, or that woman becomes on fire for this program, and they take the next person through. So instead of it just being some random occurrence now where people are getting sober and nobody knows how it happened over the course of history, there's millions of us now because there's that lightning in the bottle. Right? It's duplicatable. A spiritual experience is duplicatable. And I am eternally, eternally grateful for my home group. Like I said, we're a big book study meeting. We go through the big book, line by line, bring a speaker in every week. Some weeks it's 2 weeks, because if it's a long chapter, we do the four step on a big giant blackboard. Somebody comes up and bares their soul in front of 300 people and talks about their four step and writes the columns down on a big whiteboard on the back wall. It has been an incredible journey. I am so grateful. And it's only, right, through God's grace that I'm here. I get to do a whole bunch of other cool stuff, right? I get to go to meetings. I get to drive an hour and a half on a Labor Day weekend and come out to Quakerstown, Pennsylvania, where you find folks. I get to do stuff like that. I get to work with other men and see that light come back on in their eyes, right? I get to be there for my family members who are struggling, all right, or sickness or health issues. I get to show up, but I only get that as a result of that grace. And what happened was it was this program and those 12 steps that put me in contact with that power, right? Those 12 steps introduced me to the God of my understanding. And what I've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years now is, all right, I get it that it's through God's grace that I'm sober. But, like, I'm an inquisitive kind of dude, right? I did a lot of stuff back in the old days where I had experiences with God, right? Little piece of paper on the tip of my tongue. I have a really cool spiritual experience, right? But that was the only way in, was to put that paper on my tongue and have that experience. I can have it anywhere now, driving, fishing, boating, walking, running, laying in bed. It doesn't matter. I don't need some chemical to have that experience now. It's accessible to me at any time. And the only way that I was able to do this, and I'll wind this up real fast, I went through to work again with my current sponsor a couple times. The way his house is laid out was obviously, you know, kitchen table. Again, that's a big thing with us, right? We're sitting at his kitchen table, and he's got this little hallway that goes to his front door. So I ring the doorbell, I come in down the hallway, and I walk into his kitchen. And we sit at that kitchen table and we go through this process all over again. And he tells me that what this is designed to do is clear that hallway of all that guilt and all that shame and all that remorse and all those resentments and all those harms and all those relationship problems and all the crap that's blocking me or keeping the access denied from that power. So I go through this process. I clean out the hallway. And when his front door's open and it's facing east towards the Atlantic Ocean and the sun's coming through, he says, when that hallway's cleared up, now I'm letting that sunlight of the Spirit shine on me. What a cool concept, man. I don't need to put something on my tongue to have that process. All I need to do is get honest with another man, be willing, right? Willingness is not my default setting, right? Willingness takes effort on my part. But once I'm willing to sit down and submit to this process and be accountable to another man, go through those steps, especially 4 through 9, right? Clean out that hallway and let that sunlight of the Spirit shine on me. I said, I'm eternally grateful for my home group because that's where I was introduced to that message that for 10 years I had never heard. Now, a lot of people tell me, oh, you know, people were talking about it. You just weren't receptive to it. I don't know if that's true or not, but whatever it is, I am glad that I heard it when I heard it, or I would not be here today. So that's all I got, guys. Yeah. Thanks for having me on here. Have a good one.